the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi everyone, I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Lifetime Income Program. We're going to cover a special topic today, more about that in just a moment.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today is Kim Fischera. He's going to discuss year-end tax planning, what the options are, what the penalties are, and what you should do given this environment where we find ourselves.
We're going to talk about a different aspect of estate planning. Now, you've listened to probably shows we've done with estate planning attorneys, everything from avoiding probate, conservatorships, and of course, estate taxes and passing on the assets to heirs. But we're going to take a different tack today and talk about a different aspect of estate planning. Now, the holidays are in front of us, and it's going to be a time where you're getting together as a family. It's a joyous time of the year, a time when you think about others. I mean, you know, think about what Thanksgiving is all about. You think about Christmas, gift giving, and even charitable giving, which we'll be doing a show on that as we get closer to the end of the year, hopefully to guide you in terms of what the tax rules are, how to pick a good charity. But today's show, it's going to be about giving, but not just giving to others.
Well, and looking at the wild turkeys running up and down the road where I live, it's the favorite time of year because I'm thinking of turkey, which has to do with Thanksgiving. Then Christmas, of course, comes, and that's a season when we like to kick back and take time off. And then it turns to this thing called taxation. We have to get ready to do it. And it pretty well shapes what everyone does in this country. We've talked about the pros and cons of the U.S. tax code, but that tends to be where we are. Another thing we'd think about in holiday times, by the way, is we think about family. And what are you going to do for your kids when you're not here anymore? Or even for your grandkids? If you were to just leave them a lump sum of money, would they know what to do with it? Or would they squander the whole thing? And do they understand the value of work and investment?
A number of years ago, I watched a movie, and it starred the late James Garner, and it was called The Ultimate Gift. And the story was basically about a multi-billionaire Texas oil man. He was coming to the end of his life. He had a terminal illness. A lot of his children had turned out to be sort of trust fund kids, just basically living off the inheritance, not really doing much, living high society. But he had a grandson that was very close to him, the son of a son that he had who had died in an airplane crash. And there was a tragedy in that. But basically what he was doing is he had this tremendous amount of wealth, and he just didn't want to pass it on to people to just spend it frivolously and not do anything with it. And the movie was based on taking his grandson through a series of character building trust exercises. And it was just really a touching movie. And if you are one of those individuals that are blessed to be fortunate enough to have a large fortune, a large estate, I highly recommend reading it. It is a very moving and touching movie, a very happy ending, but it deals with some of the issues we're going to be talking about on today's program, about character building, about something that you want to pass on, not just the money that you have, but you want to pass on something of value. And as many of you know, and especially those of you who are wealthy, wealth carries with it a lot of responsibilities. Somebody that has wealth can do things that others can't. And you see this with some of the great fortunes that we have in this country today. The wealthiest man in the world, Bill Gates. The second wealthiest man in the world, Warren Buffett. They've teamed up together with the Gates Foundation. And Bill Gates, a very brilliant man himself, is turned to philanthropy with the passion, very much like John D. Rockefeller did in the last century, where it was more than just something that wanted to assuage maybe the guilt of wealth. It was something, by the way, John D. Rockefeller, if you ever read the book Titan, always tithed and always gave money. He did that even when he was 16 years old and wasn't the wealthiest man in the world. And so you see this with some of the larger estates, because that money does bring about it responsibility that comes with great wealth.
In mentioning the tithe, it's interesting because most of the major religions of the world have some process of spinning off part of what it is you make for the betterment of people around you, especially those who may not be able to do certain things or find themselves in need. But also there was another movie called Pay It Forward, if you remember, the concept of taking the benefits you have received and pay that forward to somebody else in the culture. And because of that, we all help each other and everyone is enriched by that. The difference is, I would say though, Jim, by the way, is that's a voluntary thing. You know, you do it because you believe in it rather than you do it because someone is twisting your arm or taking it from you to do it forcefully. You know, it's amazing to see what people who have very large wealth have done with their dollars. As you mentioned, you go back into past times and you look at all of the foundations. Just look at the funding credits that you see on public television at night. Rockefeller, Carnegie, Ford Foundation. Most of these people gave their fortune away to help others. As a matter of fact, I remember the original John Rockefeller. I guess he was able to make money very easily. The problem was it cost him a lot in his health. And he finally wound up eating milk and crackers because he couldn't handle the tension that it required to do what he did. It wasn't until he started giving it away that he began to heal up himself.
Yeah, it was amazing. If you ever read the book Titan, there were some pictures of Rockefeller as he was growing up. And of course, there's that one picture of, you know, he had lost his hair, that haggard, thin look. And he was unhealthy if you read about it. And it's one of the reasons why he sort of stepped down from a lot of his responsibilities, because he was a very shrewd businessman. And it was, John, when he got involved in philanthropy and got to relax. I mean, his goal was to live to be 100 years old. He never quite made it. I think it was like he died at age 97 or 98. But it was philanthropy, the good that he did, relaxation, de-stressing himself that made the difference in his life. But John D. Rockefeller, a lot of that is still being done today. As I mentioned earlier, the two wealthiest men in the world, Bill Gates and Buffett, have teamed up and will create probably the wealthiest and largest foundation in the world. And unlike Rockefeller, Bill Gates is starting his philanthropic work at a much earlier age. You know, Bill Gates is a man in his prime, and he's devoting his life to helping those less fortunate, whether it comes from education or curing disease. And neither Buffett and Gates' kids, you know, they're not going to know hunger, because the bulk of Gates' fortune and the bulk of Buffett's fortune will go to a foundation. So it's not going to the kids. Don't get me wrong. His kids are well off. Buffett gave Berkshire Hathaway stock. I think it was, John, in the 70s. Buffett gave each one of his kids something like $300,000 of Berkshire Hathaway stock. Well, you can imagine what that's worth today from 1970, because Berkshire has compounded the net asset value of Berkshire at 23% a year. Very few people in the world have that kind of a track record. But nonetheless, you see this done with larger estates where they set up foundations. You talked about the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, and the Fords. Sometimes, even today, the subsequent generations are still serving on the foundation, trying to guide how those gifts and the philanthropic work is handled. But a lot of times, the direction of the foundation has changed from the original founder's request, which happens as either foundations get larger, you get a professional board that has maybe a different interest. But nonetheless, it is something that is done as great wealth carries great responsibility. And usually when the wealth is that large, you will see this over and over again. If you watch PBS, how many of the programs are sponsored by many foundations? And that's what you see with wealthy people once they get to that level. It's such a great wealth and it carries with it responsibility. They don't want to pass it all on to the kids because sometimes it can spoil and ruin them, especially when they don't have to work or carry on or do the things that build character in life.
You know, foundations also, of course, outlive the people who create them, which is the whole purpose of it. Sometimes they tend to change the direction later on because there are other issues that come up. Sometimes they're focused on the same principles, sometimes on newer principles. So what do you do as an individual? What do you do if you are fortunate enough to have built up some kind of a fortune? You're wealthy enough, your estate is substantial, but you're not a Bill Gates or a Warren Buffett. You want to pass this benefit on to your heirs. How do you not just pass on the money, but pass on the guidelines of the values that were able to create that money and the principles of investment? And you do have some tools at your disposal. There are wills, there are trusts, tax strategies. But there's something more than that, Jim. You have to import some idea of the moral value of how money should be used. Otherwise, given a pass on to the wrong heirs, they're just going to squander that money and then it's all going to be gone.
It's amazing. There's a new document out. It's not a formal document, by the way. In other words, it's not enforceable in law. It's something that is now used in estate planning. Estate planners call it the ethical will. In most estate plans, if you think about it, you've talked to an estate planning attorney, you've heard us interview them here on the show. They focus on the distribution of assets, who gets what, complex succession planning if you have a business, or let's say things like real estate, generation planning. The ethical will goes back really to a concept that was really prevalent in the 13th century. It really relates to sort of a religious practice, John, and you know the Bible talks about this too, of a father passing on ethical teachings to their sons. And really what it is offering guidance and passing on values and wisdom accumulated over a lifetime of experience in learning. So it's a supplemental will, and it's basically you're trying to pass on knowledge, wisdom, and direction to your heirs in addition to just the assets.
Now, is this some kind of a formal document that you can employ like a will or a trust? Does it have to be somewhat legally enforceable, or how does this work?
Actually, it is an informal document because it really isn't enforceable. You're trying to say, gee, you know, I hope you do this or I hope you follow these principles, but none of those things are enforceable. And it's done in many ways today. In the movie, The Ultimate Gift, the donor, in this case, the founder of the fortune, did it through a video, which was very, very effective. In fact, I've heard of audio tapes, videotapes, photographs, or written letters, or a combination. The difference between an ethical will, the purpose is not to act as a legal document. As I mentioned, it's not enforceable. You can't tell somebody, hey, I want you to do this. What you're really trying to do, and there are some details, usually that you will find in a will and trust, but the ethical will focuses mainly here on intangibles. It's really taking the lessons the founder of the fortune learned over a lifetime. And it's the grantor's goals for the moral use of the assets that the heirs will inherit. It's the desires for the family fortune to carry on a legacy. One can think of the political legacy left by Joe Kennedy and the subsequent generation of Kennedys have all served in public office. So it's something of that nature, John. But once again, it's an informal document. It doesn't even have to be a document. It could be like in the movie, The Ultimate Gift. It was done through a video.
Well, if we look at these issues, Jim, say you're a parent, you don't just want to have your kids show up at the reading of the will, you know, the traditional scenario, and to my son, so-and-so, I bequeath this and that. This is something you might more, A, want to train your kids into, and B, to discuss with them directly.
Well, I mean, obviously, it would be a great thing to do during the holidays as families get together, you know, one-on-one. But, you know, you can have a conversation and, you know, you live 5 years, 10 years, or even longer, who will remember that conversation? So family get-togethers are a great time to do this, but it may not be possible. You know, let's say your kids live a distance from you now. They've moved on, gone on with their life. There could be issues of time. So ethical wills usually are written. They're done in audio form. Video is very popular today. I mean, you don't even need a video camera. Heck, you could do it with your smartphone today. And in the movie, The Ultimate Gift, that was done. It was done with a series of videos of various character building exercises he wanted to put his grandson through to see if he would pass these tests. And if he did pass the test, he didn't know this, in the end, he would inherit the bulk of his grandfather's fortune because the grandfather didn't feel good about leaving it to the children. And we've seen this recently, and I'm not going to mention the family, where the grandfather saw what happened with his children and grandchildren and the way they messed up their lives, the lives that they were living, that in the end, he took the fortune and donated it to a foundation rather than outright gift to his heirs.
Well, in talking about this movie, what kind of issues were discussed in there? I mean, life is similar to the movie. There are lessons to be learned. Theoretically, your kids should be learning those already. and then these would be incorporated in the wishes you express in these directives.
Well, I mean, there were a number of issues, and they all are what I call qualitative issues. None of them were financial. Things like the greatest life lessons in terms of how it impacted you. Think of those events in your life that were sort of crossroads and things that you went through under trial and the lessons that you learned from that. So you want to impart that. Maybe there's a lesson that you would want to impart to your heirs and say, this is what happened to me, and this is what I went through, and this is what I learned from it. How about mistakes that you've made and what you've learned? I know, at least in my investment career, the greatest learning lessons I have made is not so much from the successes that I've had, but also from probably the mistakes. Because when you make a major mistake or a mistake happens, it's really the key of what you learn from the outcome. You know, things like what values or beliefs that you hold that are especially significant to you and explaining why. It may be in terms of a family fortune, let's say the founding of a Fortune 500 company, what challenges confront the family, especially in the future of carrying on the business, business contacts that you have that you would like continued. In the movie, The Ultimate Gift, the founder's closest friend was an attorney, and it was that attorney that was sort of entrusted to make sure the grandson passed the test, and if he did, would then distribute the wealth. So there's business contacts. You know, think about it. If you're the one that founded the business, started the business, you may have some particular insights in that business or from a lifetime of knowledge and experience that you would want to pass on. I mean, you know, as we get older, hopefully we get wiser. Well, you're passing on some of that wisdom. And then there's maybe things that you did in your life that you're most proud of, things that you accomplished, proud of the lessons that you learned or the experiences that you went through and how you came out of it. And this is what you want to pass on. And also, it could be some things in your life that you weren't proud of, or maybe some regrets you have, and why they are regrets. So really, John, remember the old biblical tradition, just as the patriarch of the family was about to die, he had called the son in and pass on the blessing. It was sort of in this kind of tradition, and it was something that was practiced in the Middle Ages, where the oldest son would usually inherit the estate. And it was something that the head of the family, maybe the lord, the duke, would want to pass on to his son. And it was a tradition, really, that goes back to the Middle Ages, if not to biblical times.
Well, it does sound like a biblical blessing. One of the sobering proverbs that I read one time was that if you're wise, you're wise for yourself. And it means you can be wise and you can hopefully transmit that wisdom to other people if they themselves wish to be wise, but you can't force them to be wise, you know. So you can bestow blessings upon your children. And of course, it was traditional to pass it down to the oldest son in the Old Testament, if we're talking about biblical things. But hopefully you could pass on wisdom. But the wisdom, remember, is the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is knowing facts, and people can have lots of those in their head. But wisdom is the experience of having applied those facts and how they worked for people in times past and trying to avoid mistakes and do positive things.
Yeah, and it could be more than just that. I mean, there's legacy type issues. I mean, look at the wisdom of looking at the future, and especially somebody that has had a lifetime of wisdom and experience, you can see things far out that maybe others don't. And that was something that we saw in The Ultimate Gift. In everything, business relationships, you know, could be very important, that you had advisors that you trusted that you would want to continue. And in the case of The Ultimate Gift, it was an attorney that was his best friend. And also, you may have some insights in terms of handling future challenges that you see coming to the business or maybe the family itself. I mean, you know, you think of some of the philosophical beliefs that have been handed down. I mean, one of the ones that comes to mind is Sam Walton and his idea about serving people, making sure that the company always tried to get the best prices to its customers, and also the great responsibility that comes with having large wealth rather than just living off it and living a nice, easy, comfortable life, not worrying about others, but, you know, something that goes beyond that and is giving. In The Ultimate Gift, the grandson starts a charity. I don't want to give away the story, But this charity comes about from a passion from a dying young child. And so he develops this passion, as you see. For example, take a look at Bill Gates's passion in terms of curing diseases and getting people educated. So it's something that, you know, it's really quite moving. And I'm going to recommend at the end, you really pick up and watch this. And especially if you are one of the fortunate ones to have a large estate and a great fortune.
Well, with great wealth brings great responsibility. Sometimes if you tend to struggle for moral perfection, there comes with it a sense of duty and or stewardship and a tradition in preserving vital components in a family legacy and also in society for that matter.
What the ethical will is really trying to do is impart values, wisdom, as I mentioned, and pass that on. And one of the great authors, F. Scott Fitzgerald, he talked about the wealthy are different, and they really are. They have the ability to do things that the less fortunate can. The money that they have gives you power and influence. I mean, just take a look at this political election. You can influence politics for the good or bad. You think of the great fortunes and the jobs that have been created. Think of the products and the services that we enjoy today that enrich our lives that were created by these great entrepreneurs, whether it's Bill Gates or a Steve Jobs or a Sam Walton. And I mean, you think about it. I mean, let's take about the world's most valuable company, Apple Computer. They changed the music industry. They changed computers and they changed phones. And it is really something that, you know, these people had. It's too bad somebody like Warren Buffett doesn't write an investment book because he can impart so much. Others have gleaned a lot by following Buffett, attending his meetings and reading his annual reports, which are just a fountain of wisdom in themselves on managing money and managing business. But I do recommend that you watch the movie, The Ultimate Gift. It's with James Gardner, and it is just one of those feel-good movies. It's a great one if you guys are looking for something to watch over the holidays with the family. And it has a great moral lesson about building character. And that is really what the ethical will is all about.
Well, it's time to put this week's show into perspective, and we usually do that by means of a case study. So this is going to be interesting because before we've talked about preserving wealth and making optimal choices, especially for investments, investing in dividend-paying stocks. Now we're talking about wise choices in passing on your wealth. And of course, the names have been changed to protect the people and their privacy.
In this week's case study, it's going to relate to the topic we just covered. It's Jack, and we're going to call him Jack and Evelyn Carter. Jack built a very successful dealership and farm equipment in the Midwest. We worked with him in the sale of his company to a foreign public company, a corporation for seven figures. So we're talking about an estate here with substantial wealth. And one of the goals that we started out initially was to minimize the tax, especially in this case, selling a business with substantial capital gains. And so it began with the sale of the business and structuring it to minimize taxation. Obviously, you know, when you're paying 23, almost 24% capital gains tax with the Obamacare tax, and also here in the state of California, you have 13.3%. So you're almost talking about almost 37% or more in capital gains taxes and combined federal and state taxes. So it began with a sale of a business that we helped to structure in terms of minimizing taxes.
But isn't there a tax upon the sale of a company? I mean, there's a capital gains tax, but it's at a lower rate than ordinary income.
Not if it's a C corporation. If you own a C corporation, which is what most public corporations are, and many private enterprises are set up as C corporation, basically when a company buys you out in exchange for stock, you're exchanging your stock for the stock in the new company. So there's no tax on the takeover of the company unless there is cash given. For example, there's a current sale going on right now, or a proposal of a takeover of a company. And in this takeover, about 20% of the takeover value would be given in cash, which would have to be recognized as a capital gain. But in this case, it was stock for stock, so there was no tax on the takeover. The only tax would be upon the sale of the new stock that would be owned. And since the stock in this case, in the Carter's case, the stock represented the major asset of the Carter family, and as I mentioned, there would have been a 23.8% federal capital gains tax, and there would have been a 13.3% California tax. So in order to avoid the tax on the sale, because eventually they were going to want to sell a substantial portion of the public stock, we set up what was called a charitable remainder trust. We transferred a significant amount of stock to the trust, and a couple things happened. The present value of the stock that was transferred, because given the life expectancy of both Jack and Evelyn, it was roughly a joint life expectancy about 20 years, meaning that the charity was unlikely to get the proceeds until 20 years down the road when both Jack and Evelyn passed away. So they use a discount rate and they bring it back to present value. You got a tax deduction. So Jack and Evelyn got a tax deduction, which allowed them to withdraw substantial amounts of income from their IRA rollover, which was Jack's pension fund. They were able to sell the stock, and we took what was called a 5% distribution rate, meaning that they would have to take out 5% of the value of the charitable trust each year to meet those requirements. But the great thing about it, John, is we avoided 37% or more taxation in transferring the stock to a charitable remainder trust where they could sell the stock, not lose almost 40% of the assets, and get a 5% income, which would be taxed as ordinary income, by the way. And eventually, what was left outside the charitable trust, the balance of that would go to their last survivor, their three children. But in the charitable trust, upon Jack and Evelyn's death, it would go to three specific charities that they identified in advance.
Now, what about the balance of assets? Was all of the stock put in the charitable trust?
I would say almost 60% of the stock was put in the charitable trust, but there were other substantial assets. There was Jack's IRA rollover, which was several million dollars. They had some real estate holdings, including a farm, ranch, commercial buildings, which the business was housed in. So there were substantial assets. But here's the key thing, and this gets back to what you've seen done in very, very wealthy families. The assets would not go to the kids on the death of both Jack and Evelyn. Now, on the death of the first spouse, the way we set it up, it was kind of like the test. It was almost like the ultimate gift. In fact, I gave Jack the movie to watch, and it sort of, he was already thinking in this direction. But on the death of the first spouse, each one of the kids would be given $1 million outright. And the second spouse or surviving spouse, whether it was Jack or Evelyn, would then watch how that money was handled, what the kids did, and there was an election to give additional money, millions of dollars, depending on what they did. So they were going through the test. All right, kids, here's $1 million. Let's see what you do with this amount of money before we even consider giving even more. But here's what we were doing, John. We were building a legacy here. The balance of the estate would be held in trust for the next generation. So the children would get the income from the trust, but not the principal. So basically, we were setting up a legacy for the second generation.
Well, it's interesting that given the bequest to each kid, but the bulk of the estate to charity and to grandkids, was there a reason that you didn't want to move the assets directly to the heirs? And it's almost like a generation skipping principle here. It's not the first time I've heard of that.
Well, there were a couple things. Number one, there was the outright test with each kid getting $1 million upon the death of the first spouse. Secondly, the amounts involved here were so substantial that they would be life-altering. And Jack was big on work. He never even graduated from high school, just had business savvy, worked his way up, built a fortune, and earned it the hard way with blood and sweat. And there was a strong working ethic that he had in mind. His kids were well educated, but the amount of assets were so large that even just receiving the income was going to be life-changing when the last spouse passes on. So the assets in this case were too large, Jack having a strong, strong work ethic, and he was afraid that it would influence the outcome if the kids got the principal outright, and especially with some of the spouses who might have a different view of what to do with the money. So that's why it was not distributed to the kids completely. It was just basically far too much money And he wanted his kids to work. He wanted them to be no different than anybody else. Jack and Evelyn had no heirs, even though they were very, very wealthy. And hence, like The Ultimate Gift, there was a $1 million distribution to each kid upon the death of the first spouse just to see how they handled the money. And, you know, we're talking about an estate valued well over $30 million that would be inherited. So, you know, imagine what it would have been had they not set up the charitable trust. It would have been well over $50 million. So this is one reason. I mean, if you think about it, inheriting $30 million for three kids, each getting one third or the income from one third, you take a 3% dividend yield or bond yield, John, that's $300,000 a year in income in today's terms. And who knows what the value of these assets are going to be 10, 15 years, especially in Evelyn's side where they live into their 90s. So it's really what we're talking about here is building a legacy so that when the last spouse is gone, not only are the children going to be well off just based on income, but it's also building a legacy for the next generation, which is why you see these large foundations today, like the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, and so many others that you see sponsoring like PBS, the Gates Foundation. It's really, I think, responsible of large families because they know how it can alter the lifestyle. I can think of one fortune, and I'm not going to mention what the business is because you'll know who I'm talking about, where a substantial amount of assets were gifted to the kids. And I'm talking about hundreds of millions of dollars for each one of the children. And, you know, I don't want to mention who they are, but they became trust fund kids, indolent, irresponsible, and the grandchildren were even worse. And so, you know, several billion dollars were given away during the founder's lifetime, but at his death, the balance of his estate, which was quite substantial, ended up going into a foundation because the way he saw the money dissipated and the lifestyles that changed as a result of having this great wealth. So it does carry with it a lot of great responsibility, and it is why you see this. So let me recommend this. If the holidays are coming up, you're getting together with family, if you're fortunate enough to be one of those families of great wealth, highly recommend watching The Ultimate Gift. It will really impact you. It's uplifting. It's a great movie anyway, even if you don't have a lot of wealth that you're in that position. It's just a great family movie. It's very uplifting, and I highly recommend it. You can get it on Netflix or order the DVD on Amazon. I thought about this as we were going through the Carter's plan, and they were already thinking in this direction. And when they watched The Ultimate Gift, it really hit them and spoke to them because that's exactly what they were thinking.
And coming up next, Kim Fischera, year-end tax planning, options, penalties, and oh, what is a person to do? Funny you should ask that question. I have a feeling he's going to answer it.
Well, in just a few weeks, we're going to be entering the holiday season of the year. Thanksgiving is coming up. Following that, we're right into Christmas season and New Year's. Now, the last thing on your mind right now is probably taxes. But for some of you, you should be thinking about it. Joining me on the program is Kim Fischera. He's a CPA. And Kim, you know, most people, let's say, are working in the private sector or even the government sector. They're getting paid. They have money withheld from their paycheck, so they're paying into the tax system. Let's talk about those individuals who, in addition to, let's say, having wages withheld or they may be retired, have to make quarterly estimates to pay their taxes. Let's talk about some of the rules and some of the things that they can get hit. In other words, if they don't pay enough taxes, can you explain that?
Sure, Jim. It's nice to be with you again. Typically, people that pay estimate payments are those that have other sources of income coming in. I mean, normally if somebody is a straight W-2 employee, it's a non-issue as long as they're withholding enough. But where we get into this problem would be retirees that have pension income or IRA distributions and they're not electing withholding, or even large Social Security income that doesn't have withholding. Also small business owners with flow-through entities that have flow-through income from S-Corps, LLCs, sole proprietorships. In those situations, it's important to do some planning because there are underpayment penalties if you don't pay the taxes as you go. The general rule the IRS has is that each taxpayer is required to pay 90% of their tax as they go throughout the year. There are exceptions to that rule. There is an exception that does allow somebody to pay in an amount equal to the prior year liability, or in some cases 110% of that, and be exempt from the penalties. But estimate payments are due 4 times a year based on specific dates. And if they're paid after those dates, you can be subject to these penalties. They're not onerous penalties. It's a small interest rate, basically. But we try to avoid those issues, and we can do that through planning in advance, making sure the estimate payments are high enough, or in some cases, doing it through an additional payroll bonus that sends some of that money to the IRS in the state of California to cover the taxes that way.
You know, it seems to me, Kim, a couple of cases where this might be applicable. Let's say that you're retired, you finally turn age 66, you're taking your Social Security payments, and depending on your amount of income, 85% of your Social Security, or up to 50%, depending on your income, could be subject to tax. So that would be, it seems like, something very applicable that you might want to talk to an accountant about your estimates. What about, Kim, a situation where we always know that November and December are usually pretty good periods for the market. And a lot of times, mutual fund companies will distribute their capital gain distributions in the fourth quarter. So you're going along, you're not expecting anything. And because the market was having a good year, let's take example 2013, where the market was up 30%. All of a sudden, December, you're getting these big capital gain payments on your mutual funds. What happens in that case where your income can be altered in a considerable way, depending on what the market does? How does the IRS view that? If, say, for example, all of a sudden you've been paying your regular taxes, but in the month of December, you get this big distribution.
Well, the IRS does allow, there are a couple exemptions from the general 90% of paying your tax 90% throughout the year. One's the look-back safe harbor rule that I mentioned. There's another method, it's a little more complicated, but it's the annualized income method. And what that basically means is that if you have a large hit or a large chunk of income in one period, you don't have to go back and increase your estimated payments for those prior quarters as long as you make a large estimated payment to cover that tax in the period that you receive the income and your accountant understands how to do this computation on the tax return. You can avoid that penalty. But the bottom line is you need to do the planning to get there. I mean, people that have a lot of security transactions, or in this example that you mentioned, you know, large income from capital gain distributions at the end of the year, people that sell real estate, people that have pass-through entities with unpredictable amounts coming through them, really are good candidates for tax planning.
So given the fact, if, let's say, you're now starting to receive Social Security, or you have significant capital gains, or, you know, maybe you own individual stocks, and all of a sudden you're hit with these capital gains, you might want to talk to your accountant. Let's talk about other forms of estimated payments. Let's say you have a business, you're having a good year. You talked about outside income. What are the things effectively that you can do this time of the year, Kim? Because we talked about if you got, let's say, Social Security or an unexpected windfall from investments that you've made, you need to make some estimates or talk to your accountant. But what about, let's say you're running a business or you're self-employed? I guess the real question is, here we are in the fourth quarter of the year. Who should be doing tax planning? Is it really a necessity for most people or just a certain select group of taxpayers?
Well, that's a great question, Jim. It's not for everybody. I mean, I'd say a lot of our clients, I don't know what percentage, maybe 60%, really don't need tax planning. Those folks that need tax planning are, I'll try to run through a list here. People that have a lot of security transactions, somebody who might have a large real estate gain from the sale of investment property, owners of businesses, as I said earlier, sole proprietorships, S corporations, partnerships, LLC owners, somebody who has a new job or a termination in a job or a large bonus, somebody who starts a new business, those people really need to do some tax planning. People that are just W-2'd or, you know, on fixed income and really don't have any changes throughout the year don't really need to worry about it in most cases. I'd say the majority of the tax planning that we do actually starts about now. We do a lot of tax planning between now and the end of the year. And I'd say the majority of those clients are small businesses, the S-Corps and the partnerships, because, I mean, in some cases, their income went way down and they've already paid too much in estimated payments. So we have to adjust for that. In many cases, the income's going up. They've got S-corporate flow-through income that has no taxes withheld on it. And we either adjust the estimates or we adjust their bonus at the end of the year to make sure we withhold maybe extra to cover the income that's going to flow through that entity. But businesses are moving targets and things change throughout the year. There might be transactions that occur in the end of the year that they didn't anticipate. So what we try to do is, you know, first figure out what the situation is, right now based on the projected income for the rest of the year. And then once we see what the bottom line is or what the damages are or not, then we can also play some what-if scenarios and decide, hey, maybe we should buy this big piece of equipment and get some write-off to bring the income down. Maybe we should have a small business prepay a bunch of expenses in advance. Maybe there's a way to have the small business owner defer invoicing, you know, defer receiving more money before the end of the year. So small businesses are great candidates for tax planning, and they typically need it. And those that ignore it end up with these huge surprises after the end of the year, which we try to avoid that because it's often painful.
You know, Kim, let's talk about business planning, making estimates. We talked about that. It seems to me one of the things that is underutilized for a lot of self-employed individuals is things like pension plans where, you know, whether you're setting up a SEP IRA, a 401k program, a defined benefit, that seems to be some of the easiest things to do. But I do know that there's certain rules, even though you may not have to fund it before the end of the year, there are certain rules where you must have the plan set up or in place before the year ends.
Yeah, that's true. For qualified plans, they have to be set up before a year end. I mean, once the year is over, our options are limited. So if we're sitting down with a client preparing their tax return, they could be an S-corp, they could be a C-corp, they could be a sole proprietorship. If the year has ended and they haven't set anything up and they come to me and say, we really wanted to fund some kind of a plan, our only option in that case is really to use a SEP, a Simplified Employee Pension Plan. Those can be set up after the end of the year, and they can be funded after the end of the year as long as it's all done before the due date of the return, including extension. So sometimes we can push it out the extended due date. For those individuals who don't have any retirement plans, the only other option is an IRA, possibly, if they qualify for that. That has to be funded by April 15th. But for everybody else that maybe wants a qualified defined contribution plan, a defined benefit plan, a cash balance plan, a 401k plan, those need to be established before the end of the calendar year. They don't necessarily have to be funded completely for the company contribution until after the end of the year, but they have to be funded before the end of the year. Now, 401k plans, what a lot of people don't realize is if you're a single owner business, sole proprietorship, corporation, whatever, if you're the only owner, a very attractive option is to do the single owner 401k plan, which allows somebody to put the full deferral amount away, which is at least $17,500. And then in addition to that, have the company contribute a percentage of compensation over and above that. So that's a very attractive way to go for somebody who's a single owner. But again, those need to be set up right away. I mean, this is the time to do it.
And Kim, isn't there also an accelerated provision for 401k contributors once they reach age 50? Because I know, I think, what is it? The standard contribution is 17.5, but over age 50, isn't there a catch-up provision of $5,000 that somebody can take advantage of? And the reason I'm thinking of that is, let's say you're an individual and in the month of December, the company decides to distribute a bonus to you, which could be taxed at your highest bracket. Might make more sense to put some of that in a 401k program.
You know, it makes a lot of sense to do that. Yeah, it's actually $5,500. So you can do 17.5 plus another $5,500 to get up to 23. I think in 2015, it might go up a little bit. So they might have increased the amounts for that. But yeah, 401k plans are the first line of defense against paying taxes for most wage earners. And a lot of them are underutilized. I mean, I have clients that come in here and they're making these big six-figure incomes. And I look and they're not fully funding their 401k plan, even when the company's going to do matching. I mean, that's throwing money away. So it's a psychological thing for some people. And the beauty of a 401k plan is that if you set it up in advance so that you'll max it out, including that catch-up by the end of the year, you will adjust your standard of living so you don't spend the money. After a while, you won't notice the money's even going in there. But if you try to play a big catch-up amount at the end of the year, it's tougher because you have to come up with that cash.
So outside of that, I know that there are other things that can happen too, Kim. Let's talk about this. Let's say that you're selling a business where there may be capital gains, so you may even want to consider, especially if your business is being taken over by a public corporation, things like a charitable trust and other advanced tax planning techniques. But outside of, let's say, pensions, what really is left and available? I know you can deduct, for example, the interest on your home to a certain extent, your state taxes to a certain extent, medical expenses, things like investment fees. Can you talk about some of the itemized deductions that people might want to take advantage of? And aren't there some limitations now under the new tax law, depending on income, where they phase some of those deductions out?
Yeah, I mean, itemized deductions, they're all over the place as far as where the rules are at. I mean, first of all, you already mentioned a lot of them, but sometimes people will prepay their real estate taxes or prepay their California taxes by bunching those up before the end of the year. But you have to be careful there, too, because real estate taxes and state income taxes are not deductible for alternative minimum tax. So when we do planning, we very carefully look at how much an individual is able to prepay in those two categories before they lose the benefit on the federal return because of the non-deductibility. So that is an issue. You know, as far as medical deductions, those are limited to, it's now a 10% of adjusted gross income limitation unless you're over, I think, age 65, you still get the 7.5% limitation. But what that means is your medical deductions have to exceed a percentage of adjusted gross income before they're deductible. So the way to handle that in some circumstances is to try to bunch them all up in the same period. So if you can prepay all those before the end of the year and just have a lot of them so you exceed that threshold, that can help you. When it comes to investment fees, tax prep fees, under the miscellaneous itemized deduction section, also employee business expense go there, they're subject to a limitation of 2% of adjusted gross income. So before you can deduct those items, you have to, number one, exceed the 2% limitation. And also, they're not deductible for alternative minimum tax either. So you have that issue. So there's very limited benefits when it comes to miscellaneous itemized deductions and sometimes real estate taxes and California taxes. Charitable contributions, I mean, I have clients that like to donate to charitable organizations, give a percentage of their income. That's a great way to get a deduction because there's no limitation for alternative minimum tax.
Kim, let me stop you there. So if you're making a charitable contribution, that doesn't hurt you when it comes to, let's say, alternative minimum tax?
No, it doesn't. That's not subject so far unless Congress changes it. But right now, that's fully deductible. Now, if you donate too much and you exceed a certain percent of adjusted gross income, like 50%, in some cases 30%, then the charitable contribution carries forward up to 5 years. So, you know, the only problem we'll typically have is if somebody sets up a charitable remainder trust and there's a huge charitable deduction in 1 year, we have to make sure we can utilize that for the next 5 years without losing the benefit. But that's very rare. We don't get into that situation that often.
Kim, let's talk about the issue of AMT, because this is something I know when it was put in place, and you and I can remember the days, Kim, I can remember the 80s, where you could use tax shelters in the month of December and zero out your taxes. So they came up with the AMT. They changed some of the tax laws that made tax shelters less advantageous to use from tax planning, and they put in the AMT, and the idea was, hey, if you're super rich and you're using all these tax shelters to avoid tax, we're going to make sure you pay something. And that was the original intent, but over the years, they never really fully indexed it, and a lot more individuals in the middle class tax-paying range got caught by it. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's unfortunately true. The AMT, nobody quite understands it, and it's one of those insidious backdoor issues that it's not on the front page of your tax return. So the AMT is an alternative calculation that's done in the background that removes certain things from being deductible, to simplify it. So what we do is we run another computation starting with your adjusted gross income, and we add back certain things like real estate taxes, California income taxes, miscellaneous itemized deductions. I think exemptions are added back. There's a number of items that are more complex that sometimes apply. And what we come up with is a new level of taxable income, alternative minimum taxable income. There is an exemption that gets offset against that, but the higher your adjusted gross income is, the lower that exemption goes. And so this alternative minimum taxable income is subject to a different rate. And what we end up doing is we take the higher of either the alternative minimum tax or the regular tax. And whatever the highest one is what goes on the tax return. So many middle-class Americans are being subject to the AMT, and maybe this was not the original intention of the law, but as you said earlier, because of the lack of indexing of the exemption with inflation, a lot of us are being hit by it.
Kim, is it really, from a tax planning point of view, I mean, we talked about pensions, we talked about, you know, you can make charitable gifts, things of that nature, but haven't they really taken away a lot of the things that you can do? I mean, when I think of, let's say, investing, okay, I can go into dividend stocks, which are taxed at a lower rate than interest income. I can go into maybe tax-free bonds, or I can go into things like REITs or limited partnerships listed on the exchange where part of the income is partially sheltered. But on the investment side, that's pretty much it. I mean, you and I know that the days in real estate where you could buy real estate, take the excess losses and use it to shelter against your income, that's gone.
Yeah, that's gone for most people. And it's really gone for those people who can afford real estate. I can't tell you the number of times people will come in here that are in large six-figure income, and without consulting us, they'll go out and buy some California real estate with very low down payment, have a large real estate loss, and they're thinking they're going to write it off. And I have to give them the bad news and tell them, sorry, but it's suspended. You don't lose the loss, but it gets carried forward until you sell the place or show some positive passive income. You know, somebody who has adjusted gross income of under $100,000 can write off up to $25,000 of their real estate loss, should they have one. But those people may not be great candidates to afford real estate investments. So there are some limitations there. You're right. I mean, back in the early 80s, there were no limitations on this sort of thing. So real estate could be highly leveraged. People could take large write-offs. And those days are gone. And I mean, I'm not saying real estate's a bad investment, because it's not. It's another way to balance your portfolio. But people will approach it differently nowadays than they did 20, 30 years ago. They'll buy real estate that's maybe break even or positive cash flow if they can't afford it, with the desire to eventually pay it off and turn it into something that will generate positive cash flow in their retired years.
So really, when it comes to real estate, there's a different dynamic when it comes to tax planning. So you're probably going to want to put more money down, because you're not going to be able to write off the excess losses. You're just going to carry them forward. So isn't it a matter of putting enough money down, or making sure, you know, the economics work, where at least if you do have positive cash flow, you can shelter it from, let's say, depreciation or other expenses?
Exactly. I mean, real estate's still a good investment, but people are just approaching it a little differently than they used to back in the big tax shelter days. Depending on the geography where you're buying it, you know, you have to look at the economics, like you said. Sometimes if you buy out of state, cheaper properties, you can put lower amounts down and the rent will pretty much cover the property. In California, it's tougher because properties are more expensive. But what clients will do is, in most cases, they'll try to put enough down so that the rents are covering all the expenses, and they do get the depreciation in there that'll offset, you know, some of those as well. So you really have to look at the economics. And people will hold real estate now really for appreciation. There's two reasons. I mean, one is they hold it for appreciation. The other is they hold it because they want to pay it off and turn it into something that will generate a positive cash flow when they're retired.
So we talked about AMT. We talked about some of the things that we can do, you know, things like pensions, and we talked about various strategies, whether you're putting into a 401k, charitable contributions. Kim, is there anything else that's out there that we haven't discussed, or is it really getting to be more, I guess, fewer strategies to pursue today because they've been closing a lot of these loopholes that we had? You and I have been in this business long enough. You remember what it was like in the 80s. Oh, my goodness. You had a, you know, a whole menu of different tax shelter techniques, whether you were buying limited partnership tax shelters, oil drilling programs, all kinds of things. But it seems to me, other than tax deferral, tax free, and maybe tax sheltered in the way of real estate, it boils down to maybe two or three simple tools.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. In the old days, you could buy your tax shelter. But, you know, the economics of some of those deals wasn't that great anyway. So, you know, I can't say it's a terrible thing, but it does limit our planning. I mean, what people need to do now is just be smart about it. I mean, tax planning is a matter of timing. Sometimes you're trying to defer income into a subsequent year. In some cases, we have a few situations now. We're trying to accelerate income into this year because somebody has a large NOL, so they're doing a Roth conversion in this year because they won't be taxed on it. We have clients that have options to do deferred compensation plans, so sometimes they can push salaries off into the future. So tax planning is just a matter of being aware of what your options are, being smart about it, first determining if you are a candidate or not to do tax planning, like I said earlier. You know, a lot of our clients really don't need any tax planning, but those that have small businesses, have a lot of activity in the market, are selling properties, they really need to do a checkup and just look at what's going on and just understand what their options are. I mean, another thing we didn't mention is HSA plan. I encourage a lot of clients that have high deductible health insurance to use an HSA, a health savings account, as a above the line deduction. That's a great way to go. California doesn't recognize it, but it's still deductible on the federal return.
Kim, can you explain that for our listeners, what it is and how it works and what are the limitations?
I've used it for years because I've always been a believer of I'd rather pay lower premiums than have a higher deductible. That's just my own philosophy. And so what goes along with that strategy is the HSA plan, health savings account. And it's like a glorified IRA. Depending on whether it's a plan for a single individual or a family, you can put a certain amount of money into this, and you can do it up to the due date of the tax return. It looks just like an IRA deduction on the front page of the return. The only downside is California still hasn't recognized it, and I doubt they ever will, so you don't get the deduction on the California return. But all of the money that goes into that plan basically stays there. And in my case, I use something comparable to a bank account with low interest because I want it to be liquid. But you can then use that money to pay for your medical expenses, you know, dental, prescriptions, whatever is not covered by your high deductible insurance. My wife and I have debit cards, and we basically just use those to pay for this stuff. And the money that's used to pay for these medical expenses that comes out of that plan is tax-free. So that's the benefit of it.
You know, it seems to me, Kim, this may work even better going forward because we do know in a lot of these healthcare exchanges under Obamacare where you pay these premiums, there are huge deductibles anywhere from $5,000 to $8,000 for a family. So it seems to me like the HSA is going to be worth even more under Obamacare.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on Obamacare yet. Of course, we're going to have to get up to speed for this tax season. But you're right. I mean, I think my deductible is $5,200. Now, once you go on Medicare, you're not eligible for an HSA, so you have to stop it at that point. But for a lot of families, an HSA is a great way to go, and it's something you do individually. It's kind of like an individual retirement account. And there are some companies that will sponsor this and fund it on your behalf, but most of the clients that we have will just fund this on their own. And you can go online. My great site I use is hsabank.com. You can set the whole thing up online. Not every financial institution offers this type of a plan. You can't just go to B of A or Wells Fargo. And actually, Wells Fargo might have it. But you have to find a financial institution that offers it.
So, Kim, finally, if we were to summarize here, things that individuals ought to be considering right now towards the end of the year to avoid penalties, things that they could do to take some last-minute tax tips to maybe reduce taxes. You know, one of the things I would think of is, you know, if you got a distribution from a mutual fund where you have a capital gain, if you have something in your portfolio that has a loss to it, you might want to consider taking the loss to offset it. But anything else that we should talk about here?
No, those are the main things. And, you know, the point you just brought up, I have to stress that it's really important that clients work with their investment advisor. And if the investment advisor is not asking them these questions, they should be calling the investment advisor and saying, hey, what's going on in my portfolio? Because there could be a lot of activity in there that could be generating capital gains. And I've seen situations where, you know, somebody comes in here and they've got this $50,000 capital gain they didn't even know about. So it's important they communicate with the investment advisor, do some planning with them, bring in the tax professional, and just have a team approach to strategizing and planning beforehand. And just to wrap up, if somebody has any type of change in dependents, filing status, income going up or down, you know, large medical expenses, started a new business, new job, job termination, large bonuses, as we said earlier, stock transactions, sale of real estate. If any of these things are going on, it's a good idea to check with your investment and your tax professional and just find out. It might just be a 10-minute phone conversation to find out, hey, do I really need to sit down and do anything about this?
Kim, I appreciate you coming on the program. I know a lot of our listeners are probably thinking about the holidays, the football season, the playoffs, who's going to make it to the Super Bowl and Christmas. Huh. But we got to start thinking about taxes because, like it or not, we have to pay them. And we also have to file that tax return. Kim, if anybody would like to contact you, how could they do so?
Our number is 760-431-1220.
Well, listen, Kim, thanks for joining us on the program.
It was my pleasure, Jim, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Well, that concludes this week's program. And once again, you're probably already thinking about the holidays. In fact, I was out in the stores this weekend, and some of the stores are already putting up Christmas decorations. So you're going to be thinking about the holidays. But remember, if you are in a situation, as we discussed in this interview, whether you have to pay quarterly tax estimates, you're getting capital gains, or you haven't set up a pension plan, by all means, please contact your financial advisor or your tax accountant and take advantage of it. You've got 2 months to get this done. You don't want to wait and procrastinate to the last minute. Well, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on this week's Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.